Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Just as some context, Langkelly Chase is an independent funder. We principally fund in the area of multiple disadvantage, homelessness being one of those disadvantages. I was delighted to be asked to speak today. In this presentation, I want to examine how systems determine the kind of services that are available to socially excluded people. My preoccupation with systems comes from a conviction that anyone who seeks to make a difference in this area will find themselves operating within a set of norms, assumptions, and beliefs from which it is virtually impossible to escape. And so if we are unable to surface and distinguish these, then we are doomed to be shaped by them. To start with the concrete, I want to draw on an anecdote from my own career. In 2002, I was responsible for the Social Exclusion Unit's report on reducing reoffending by ex-prisoners. And in our trawl of the evidence, we found that prisoners who were released homeless from prison were much more likely to reoffend than those who had homes to go to. So we concluded, quite naturally, that reducing homelessness on release should form a central part of our emerging strategy. From among the agencies that might have taken responsibility for this issue, it was the prison service that stepped up and issued a performance target to its governors to reduce the numbers of prisoners released homeless. And from among the interventions that might make a difference, there was only one that really had any kind of outcome evidence attached to it, and that was the provision of housing advice in prisons. So it was this model that was recommended to governors from across the prison estate. So what was the result? Well, the reoffending of short-term prisoners, namely those most affected by homelessness, did not fall. And what about homelessness? That has always been a great deal harder to ascertain. Housing advice in prisons is something of a misnomer. We should actually call it hostel placement. And in truth, it wasn't a target to reduce homelessness. It was a target to reduce people being released to no fixed abode. As one governor said to me, I will hit my homelessness target easily, but I won't make a dent on homelessness. The point of this anecdote is to illustrate the stuff of which policy is made. When spotting a clear correlation between one piece of data and another, our reflex as policymakers was to leap on that correlation and then drive the system to deliver a controllable output that was the closest approximation available to an outcome over which, in fact, we literally had no control. If I'm honest, we didn't really stop and ask questions like, why are these people homeless? Is the profile of homeless ex-prisoners different in other ways from non-homeless ex-prisoners? And perhaps most importantly, do these people view homelessness as the cause of their reoffending? And indeed, do they see a place in a hostel as a plausible route out? Missing entirely was any appreciation that people being released back to their homes were far more likely to have family and friends still around them, as well as perhaps jobs and a set of skills that we badge as tenancy sustainment. And indeed, they were probably far less likely to have hard drug problems, mental health problems, and a mountain of debt. In other words, we chose to view homelessness as an atomized need to be met, rather than as an indicator of wider issues with people's social and familial resilience. As you will know, this is quite typical of our wider approach to social policy. A need is isolated at the level of an aggregated population group. It is then aligned to a plausible solution, which is then systematized. Job done. If I'm brutally honest, this happened in the face of a great deal of evidence about the chronic chaos found in the lives of the highest reoffenders, people who had been abused and neglected from an early age, passed around institutions and family members, caught in a cycle of harm and self-harm, while living, for the most part, at the extreme edges of a viable existence. Now, I still think all prisons should have an housing advice service, and it's fair to say that this wasn't the only service that we managed to roll out. But that's not the point I'm driving at. My point is that we have a way of explaining social problems to ourselves that is grotesquely reductive, that looks at a promising statistic and imagines that a solution might somehow spring from it, that suggests that a chronically chaotic life might actually turn on a transaction as banal as being handed the address of a hostel. So what is this way of explaining that I mean? Most obviously, I mean the way in which the majority of social policy is underpinned by the discipline of economics, with its confidence that human choices and behaviours can be accurately understood, modelled, predicted, and planned for. The limitations of this model have been popularly critiqued by people like Paul Olmerard and Stephen D. Leavitt, who have helped expose the blind spots in the standard economic modelling, revealing the often subtle and complex causes of behaviour that are hidden from the view of most policymakers and economists. These are blind spots which are slowly being acknowledged by some in policy, but this small minority is scarcely at the foothills of the work needed to disrupt the damaging paradigms that still prevail. The most relevant paradigm for my argument today has been the choice made by successive governments to shape our care services around the management of risk. The risk model is now at the core of most child and adult support services, from family support through to homelessness and drug treatment through to criminal justice, and is a classic product of the quasi-science of economics. Where did this model come from? To my mind, it surfaced with the closure of our asylums and spikes in the 60s and 70s, which put paid to the idea of a safety net within which risk could effectively be institutionalised. This change immediately triggered a demand for an alternative, all-encompassing model that could help us understand and predict the behaviour of those newly at liberty. Emboldened by new social sciences, we embrace the idea that someone's ability to live functionally and independently in a community could be established through an assessment of the risks posed to that functionality and independence. This predictive model has dominated for so long that most of us don't notice how comprehensively it shapes our assumptions and behaviours. And this means that we don't appreciate the extent to which it drives the poor outcomes that many of us are actually struggling to overcome. So I want to single out a few consequences of the risk model, some of which can be seen in my anecdote. This model has suggested that a person, in all their complexity and individuality, regardless of the highly personal life history that has brought them to this point, can be freeze-framed and understood in a standardised assessment of preordained risk factors. In doing so, it has made risk or need the point of intervention, not the person. This is really helpful for systems that need to think in terms of aggregated population groups, like the drug-using population. But it generates no insights whatever into who people actually are as human beings. As such, it has privileged efficiency as an overriding objective. Risk-based targeting of people's needs allows commissioners, but perhaps more importantly, procurement officers, to satisfy themselves that they are achieving the greatest good for the greatest number with the least resources. The model's assertion of the predictability of cause and effect has fed an over-optimistic confidence that outcomes can be planned for and even purchased. And so the pursuit of abstracted outcomes, such as reduced homelessness or reoffending, has displaced people as the core driver of our systems. Indeed, within the payment by results contracts that are now prevailing, the individual is posited as a unit of risk inside of the risk and reward model agreed between provider, investor, and commissioner. As a consequence, fidelity to evidence-based models becomes critical to commissioners and investors who need to understand whether risk is properly being managed. The provider is thereby subordinated as a neutral vehicle of these processes. Again, this is great for procurement officers as it allows them to chop and change their provider base. All of which posits the person as the object of intervention, not as the subject of their own lives, allowing policymakers and commissioners to talk about plugging people into services, which is a phrase I first heard in my social exclusion unit days and heard again very recently. The principal consequence of this is that it denies people strengths, capabilities, assets and agency, and it discounts the social capital that surrounds them. To be clear, the risk model and the way it supports the outcome model has considerable merits when the problems that we need to tackle are single, linear and simple. And its greatest merit, perhaps, has been its contribution to public health approaches, which have successfully shifted outcomes at the level of whole population groups. But the risk model has become all-pervasive, regardless of whether it's in the interests of the client group. Why? Because it really suits the worlds of policy, profession, and procurement. There is no evidence that I know of to suggest that the risk model works for people with more complex needs. On the contrary, it appears to have directly shaped the problem of multiple needs, creating rigid and exclusionary practices that are not fit for purpose when faced with complexity. It has organised services around a hierarchy of atomised needs that can be captured on paper, but don't equate to the whole person whom the worker sees and talks to. Because each need is prioritised individually in separate risk hierarchies, the individual is almost bound to be classified as a high and a low risk simultaneously. So everyone has to wait for all needs to become a high priority before holistic action can be taken. Ironically, therefore, the risk model turns out to be terrible at prevention. This atomization of need required by the risk paradigm has enabled the industrialization of care and support. We even talk about the care industry. And this is most classically seen through the division of labor. As with the production line, workers have become increasingly specialised in tasks and roles related to components of the system, and this has taken them further and further away from the whole. Just as production line workers couldn't make a television or a car, so our care workers are unable often to understand the whole person. And this is how we tend to respond to the visceral nature of human misery. We categorise and organise people into pathways and tiers. Psychologists would call it anxiety defence. It gives us the illusion of adequacy and effectiveness in the face of the full complexity of another person's life. Now, one possible counter to what I'm saying is that we have invested heavily in case management, precisely as a horizontal means of integrating services around the needs of the individual. Well, perhaps, but let's just think about the reality of case management. If your case manager identifies a need, but there's no corresponding service, too bad. If they refer you to a service and it rejects you, too bad. If they get you into a service and you don't show up, too bad. If you go to the service and you hate it, too bad. If you get a lot out of the service, but there's no follow-up afterwards, too bad. There's only so much a case manager can do administratively to knit a risk-based system together so that it approximates to the contingent human journey that an individual actually needs to take. Navigation and coordination are not the solution. They are just a way of trying to fit people into systems that weren't designed for them. So if I had my time again and I was looking at that homelessness data, what would I do differently? Clearly, I would now start with the person. As I hope I've shown, policy that is shaped by economic risk data pulls you further and further away from who people are. But what does it mean to start with the person? We've been working with the Social Research Unit at Dartington on an inquiry into youth and multiple disadvantage. And this has been a highly deliberative collaboration with young people, practitioners and decision makers. And we are starting to arrive at a set of principles which we hope might govern what it means to start with the person, regardless of your role in the system. The first principle is connection. If you ask someone who has overcome a multiplicity of disadvantage what made the difference, you almost invariably hear the same words. Someone who was there for me. Someone who took an interest. Someone who treated me as a human being. You also hear other words. Love, relationships, belonging, consistency, trust, hope, acknowledgement, kindness and encouragement. These are what matter most to people, and these are precisely the weakest points in the services on which people rely. The quality of that connection between helper and helped crops up again and again in the literature of effective practice. Yet in the incentive structures that underpin service contracts, it is displaced entirely by other more quantifiable factors that are better suited to actuarial minds. So we are now starting to explore with the Social Research Unit what an effective relationship means in this context, and what a system might look like that was designed to promote and enable the connection actually needed between two people. The second principle is being vulnerable. When faced with complexity, our instinct is to value expertise when we should be valuing humility. Complexity theorist Nassim Taleb warns against trusting anyone who offers you an answer. Rather than creating a protective armor of facts and data, we should allow ourselves to be open to the possibility that some things are not knowable, and that change will always come from places you don't expect. Real power comes when you avoid diminishing what is extraordinary in other people, and when we recognize that we will never fully be able to understand, model, predict, and plan. And Revolving Doors Agency recently produced a very powerful evaluation of Street Talk, which is a counseling service for women involved in street-based prostitution. They found that the women principally valued the service for its willingness to bear witness, not just as an intervention, but as an end in itself. The women talked about being believed, about recognition of the extent of the harm done to them, about reassurance of the normalness of their behavioural, emotional and physical response to extraordinary circumstances. Bearing witness is itself an act of vulnerability and courage, but not one you would ever find in service specifications. The third principle that flows from the others is disruption. Services that start with people are almost by definition disruptive because people's lives don't conform to public service structures or silos. But this isn't just about services. Personal change itself, of course, necessitates the disruption of patterns. And we might question how transformation is meant to happen in a system that privileges stasis and structure. Those workers who are seen to make the most difference are often described as heroes and mavericks, people who are able to clear a path. Both labels suggest someone who operates outside of norms and breaks rules. If everyday heroism is going to become the new norm, then we need to seek ways, wherever possible, to disrupt the balance of power between purchaser, provider, and end user through methodologies like co-design and co-production at every stage of the process. But more than that, we have to find ways of opening up professionally closed systems that focus our attention obsessively on a rapidly diminishing pool of state-sponsored resource. We need to reward people for their ability to marshal resource over which they have no control and for which they have no accountability, such as the contribution of community, family, and above all, the person themselves. As someone pointed out to me last week, marshalling resources over which you have no control is the definition of entrepreneurialism. In other words, risk-taking, not risk management. The final principle is plurality, by which we mean an end to the pendulum swing from one all-embracing paradigm to another, from the safety net to the risk paradigm, from outcomes to relationships, from social to individual responsibility, from the state to the market. In a complex world, multiple paradigms need to be able to coexist, as none is sufficient to describe or address the diversity of need. The value and limitations of each should be recognised without sides being drawn up for and against. All have their place, but, and this is the key, all become counterproductive when overextended. So this is the thinking we are doing with the Social Research Unit. Can it have purchase in the current climate? My strong sense is that a view is emerging among some policymakers and service leaders that failure has actually been generated by systems that are no longer able to meet the complex demands of modern society. But there is also an emergent sense of a better way of doing things based on relationships, empowerment, civic engagement, and accountability to the users of services. It won't be easy to dislodge the dead hand of the risk model as an organising principle. It is what people know, and it is how they explain the results that they promise to others. And it is who they think they are as professionals. We are trying to work through what a system would look like with those whose principles were connection, being vulnerable, disruption, and plurality. What strikes me about those principles is that they are, above all, ways of being. In the world of policy and practice, we are not used to talking about who we are being. We are much more comfortable with ways of doing. But perhaps system change, which is always interpreted as a technocratic exercise, is ultimately most likely to start from a shift in who we are being. This would require us to start reflecting much more routinely on questions like, who are we being such that lives in our society are wasted and destroyed? And who would we be being if those same lives were valued and enriched? These aren't comfortable questions, but then this isn't a comfortable subject. And the choice we face is whether discomfort acts as a barrier to change or a driver of change. Thank you very much.